Well, hey there, and welcome to episode number 69 of Groove, the No Treble podcast, which you can always find at notreble.com. My name is Mitch Joel. Let's get on with the show. So who are you and what do you do?
Hey, this is Derek Hodge, artist, composer, musician. I'm just kind of like a painter, man. I just try to paint my life in music and sound, man. And that's what I'm doing with my new album, Color of Noise.
Yeah, and it's quite a different album. I mean, this is your third solo album.
It is.
But this one's really different. I mean, in one side is you could sort of read about it like I did and discover the sort of musicianship and how you recorded it. But in following your music, I think the biggest difference isn't in that you had humans in the studio doing this live, but rather that it's either a different path or a path that has many more colors from your palette.
Yeah. You know, it's something that in reality should reflect me letting go in every way. And Color of Noise, man, it's more of an idea that was birthed over the last couple of years, man. And unfortunately, I'm using this album, this Blue Note album, you know, as a perfect introduction kind of to the world of that spirit of kind of what is noise, what is color, the question mark, what is color of noise? And that's kind of by design for people to eventually not ask questions and just let the music speak to them in their own way and own it in their own way. However it speaks to them is just as valid as it's how it spoke to me. So in that concept, I wanted to make sure when I created this that goal and that idea matched in every step of the way. And in creating the art, it was about letting go, not overly explaining the music, not overly composing things and having people just play kind of what I'm showing them or overly notating. It was about throwing out ideas, more so speaking about the emotion that spoke to me, and then going to the piano, playing the ideas, and then maybe a little bit of the melody. And then on that album, you're hearing everyone reacting in their own way in the moment by design. And that's kind of, you know, what makes this one, you know, different in every way. It's about me letting go and letting the moment and the universe just take it and run with it and make it a stamp of the time.
When people think about a label like Blue Note, I think there's a natural instinct to think jazz, classic standards. The label has evolved so dramatically in the past decades, for sure, but that is sort of the pedigree in what we think. When I think about the fact that you brought in, you know, keys, drums, turntables to do this live in a very traditional environment, in fact, a classic studio environment where you recorded it, there is this sort of thought of what kind of music will this be? And hearing you describe it that way, I wonder if you think about things like, I guess, not only genres, but what will people like, how will this attach to people? What type of people would like this?
I'm so glad you asked that, because that was kind of, that's part of the spirit around even the name of Color of Noise. You know, for me throughout my career, I'm very thankful that, you know, and blessed that people have gone on the journey with me through my artistic career. But even how I've been defined has changed, you know. At one time, as a teenager, I was just known as a gospel and R&B musician and hip-hop, you know, that was all of a sudden getting into jazz, and then later known as a jazz musician that played upright, and people did for a while didn't even know I really played electric, and then, you know, started getting known thanks to my heroes like Terrence Blanchard and beyond as a composer and a writer and all those things, you know, it's kind of evolved how I've been described over time, man. But I think, and I've never spent too much time even thinking about what people label, you know, my music and my art. And, you know, I hope that never changes, man. But I really wanted to just embrace that and say, instead of worrying about how I'm defined at all, let that question mark in itself be the concept. Because what is noise? That's all, you know, debatable, you know, and what does that look like? You know, and that was kind of the idea behind every image just being black and white. You take it and make it your own. How does it speak to you? And, you know, like with that in mind, I kind of wanted to make sure I documented that freedom and just that reckless abandon, man, in a way, and just me letting go with Blue Note, man, because Don was, in particular, he's just been just a champion and just really trying to get to the spirit of kind of what makes me tick as an artist, you know, and he seems to have always cared about that, man. And I felt this was the perfect time to create some art that I felt speaks to different sides of myself and also me letting go and me not worrying about how it's defined. But really, the attempt to define it in itself is part of the concept, how people make it their own. One might call it just instrumental music. If somebody calls it jazz, if somebody calls it just whatever, I don't really care. I just hope they let go and allow it to speak to them in a certain way.
Don is such a fascinating character. Actually, one I got to get on this show because he's definitely a bass player. People may not know this, but back in 2012, he became president of Blue Note Records. People yep. think of him primarily as, I guess, a sort of player to the stars, writer to the stars, producer. But he's taken on this real serious job and has been at it for a while. Part of this gig that I found so interesting is just your relationship with him, what he mm-hmm. brought to this album, your relationship to Blue Note because of him. When did you first meet him?
I met Don was on the side of the stage at Monterey Jazz Festival, which is where I first premiered this Color of Noise concept before recording, just in honor of that moment. You know, I met Don was I just finished playing with The Experiment with Robert Glasper and Chris Dave and Casey Benjamin. And I walked off the stage and Don was standing right there and pulled me aside and said, "Hi, you need to be part of the Blue Note family." It was that simple. And I said, "Okay, let's," and he just followed up immediately with, "Let's get your info, let's get your manager's info, and let's talk Monday." And 2 days later, we were on the phone talking about my first album, which led to Live Today. And I got to tell you, man, that my relationship with him and the label in every way has kind of been a reflection of that. You know, it's been about freedom. They've never tried to put me in a box. They've never tried to dictate how my art fits in. You know, it's been pure freedom, which has allowed an album like Live Today to happen. And then, which also allowed my second album, like The Second, to happen in the way it did, where I'm just jumping around playing all the instruments because I felt complete freedom to just be myself. Because of that, I wanted to honor that with Color of Noise, with bringing Don in, you know, just to help. If I'm talking about, like I said, being free and letting go, I wanted another set of eyes just to kind of see me through another lens, you know, through this whole process. And Don graciously embraced that. And I feel like, you know, I hear kind of the DNA of what I try to bring to the music in here. But when I think about the process, that was very much actually a classic Blue Note process where we got in studio, me and two drummers and two keyboard players, you know, minus the horns. And we just record right then and there in the moment and move on and document it. So that process was kind of, in a way, honoring Blue Note, that Blue Note legacy, even if the sound itself is kind of just, I would just say, a world American music. So it was that hybrid of process, and Don was definitely a big part of the concept and how we actually recorded and making sure it all happened in the moment. When people hear, they're hearing the guys reacting in the moment. It's not a whole bunch of takes and all that.
It's amazing to me because when I think of him, I mean, I think more of Americana and folk. Dylan, yeah. The Rolling Stones, Bonnie Raitt, even John Mayer, you know, Bob Weir, that type of world.
Yeah.
And I always have to like shift gears when I remember he's the president of Blue Note. And I'm wondering also on the production side, because he's so well known from that, from your experience in working with him, where is he the harshest? Like, what is he a stickler for that he just won't let go of?
Well, let me back up. First of all, that side of Don, I think that's another reason I love, because I actually love those styles of music as well. And actually, I'm big into songwriting, and that kind of informs my decision making, even in the sound and the way things are recorded and miking. And Don gets that, man. So that energy I love of, hey, just let the moment be. If one song is like a fall, then the next song is just all distortion and going crazy with sounds, cool. And that kind of reflects just how Don is, man. There has not been a single harsh moment. And I think that's what makes him great. I think if anything, it's the opposite. It's how little he says in a moment where you're just expecting something to be said because the person's great. And yeah, because they're great, you expect them to say, yeah, you guys can improve on this or that or change that. No, the fact that, you know, he's the biggest champion in the room when things are happening and it's all about acceptance. That's kind of been one of his greatest contributions, man. In just saying, hey, we just want to get to what's making you guys tick in the moment. And honestly, that's kind of been a constant with a lot of great minds that I know, you know, even when working with Quincy Jones and others, it's about like, let's just document something real in the moment. What do you have to say about it? And let's get out of our own way. So with that said, man, I think the shock has been not a moment of harshness with Don from day one. The Don I met on the side of the stage is the same Don that I'm producing alongside, whether it was for my album or other artist's album. And that's a testament to him.
I want to go back a little bit and talk a bit about your origin story, because in preparing for this conversation, I realized I'd known your music and I'd known your playing and I'd known your bass playing for sure, but I didn't really know your story. And as I sort of traipsing through the internet, there's not much. I mean, there is the standard bio that I guess you get to review and overview and check and see what you think and what you like. But I'm always interested in the real origin story. And I guess I want to start with this one piece of information. I don't know if it's true or not, but I was fascinated by it because it usually doesn't happen like this. But you started playing electric bass in elementary school.
I did, yes.
So normally, and I'm sure you know this, normally it's like a high school thing. It's like a 14 to 16. It's like the guitarist is already taken. The drummer is already taken. They need you. You're going to be the bass guy. Can you talk a bit about where the sound of the bass first started attracting you and why elementary? I mean, it just sounds so young to me.
Yeah. I mean, well, I'm from Philadelphia, but also we later moved to Willimboro, New Jersey. And in that culture, man, bass is definitely not the it's the opposite. It's actually not the, okay, everything else is taken, let me grab the bass. You know, bass was definitely in people's face and a popular sound, you know, in Philly, you know, hence why so many musicians from Philly play the bass, you know. And with that said, my mother, you know, came from this church in West Philly where she was on the choir with Patti LaBelle and all these. It was just an amazing musical church, man, Beulah Baptist. And the bass player, Joel Ruffin, I used to hear him and I want to be just like him. I said, he's cool. He sounds cool. And at that point, I started on drums at like 2. I started at 2, man, and had been playing drums a little bit. But when I saw him and I said, I want to play bass. I want to be just like him. And the bass was too big for my body. So in first grade, they actually put me on guitar until I grew a little bit. And then I started bass at 7 years old.
Wait, it was
Joel like Ruffin, man.
Is that like a Mustang short scale or are we still talking full scale?
Yeah, that's exactly what it was.
Okay.
That is exactly what it was. And I felt like life was good, man, because it was like marble blue. <You know? laughs> But the cool thing about it, man, also because it was a hybrid. I'm from Philly, but Willimboro, New Jersey, it's like a small town on the outskirts, 30 minutes away. But it was full of musicians, you know, and other bass players. You know, I grew up, you know, Adam Blackstone a few blocks from me, Wayne Moore from me, Thaddeus Tribbett on right around the corner from me. So bass was always a sound that I heard, and it was easy to be inspired by those around me because, you know, we were all playing and it was just a cool creative energy.
And was music really swirling in the sense of, I get the R&B and gospel and spiritual side, but I'm thinking more about jazz, hip hop, soul, rock, because there's what's happening, you know, in sort of your home and in your spiritual life. But then there's just also the impulses that you're getting from kids and peers and cousins and brothers and sisters and all that sort of stuff. How diverse was it for you? Because when I hear you now, I just think you'd be lucky to grow up in a world where you had that type of exposure to music.
I was very fortunate. And I tell people, when people ask my biggest influence, you know, I can talk specifically about the instrument and bring up the Marcus Millers and John Petitucci's and Jaco Pastorius and all of them, of course. But my biggest influence was my mother, because she would put on music every night to just listen to before I'd even heard any of them. And she would change the station every other night. And I would wake up listening to music. I'd go to sleep, you know, listen to the music. And she taught me how to listen. And without knowing, you know, I was really kind of gravitating to, okay, what is making this sound the way it sounds? You know, she was teaching me about production. She was teaching me about the DNA of a song. She's teaching me about, you know, even tone, all that without even realizing it, you know. And the fact that MTV, you know, really took off, you know, when I was a child, and she would put on music and I would hear rock music just about every other day on the TV. That actually was influencing, you know, my music. I mean, to this day, that distortion and that sound that is on my albums and all of that, that's kind of a reflection of that. Was actually some of my early influences, just as much as the Joel Smiths and Andrew Cuches and all that. So it was that hybrid of all of that. And I would say, because I left Philadelphia and really my formative years was in Willingboro, New Jersey. That was a big influence because I was around a bunch of kids that had a bunch of different influences, and we were okay with checking it all out. And I didn't feel a pressure to sound like, quote unquote, a Philly sound and all that yet. I hadn't even fully been exposed to it yet, you know. So I think that hybrid and all those influences and the melting pot, that was a big influence on me before I even went into the formative years of really shedding the instrument. And I think that was so invaluable in not letting that go to this day, because it was always about just, hey, if you're hearing something, go for it. Why not try and write for the Chicago Symphony while on tour with Common?
So you're playing, and at mm-hmm. such a young age, you're probably building up skills and chops and just capabilities at a pretty interesting click. Other players play, they don't necessarily pursue music academically. You actually go on to study things like jazz composition at Temple University and on. Can you talk about the choice or decision you made to say, music isn't just my life, it's going to be my profession, I'm going to follow it even academically? Because that's I always think when I speak to bass players, it's a very specific path when you do that. It's not just, well, I'm going to get out of high school and hit the road and start gigging.
Right.
Can you talk about that choice and why you decided to get that level of academic density?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Because actually that choice, when I think back, was very reflective of my mindset at the time and how much I valued my immediate community. Because in high school, you know, we had a really popular, really cool jazz band. And, you know, back then they had the high school competitions, and we had won Berkeley a couple of years and all this different stuff. And, you know, people thought that was the end all be all. But I ended up going to Temple University mainly because my high school band director went to Temple and he recommended it. And we revered him that much that it led to that big of an impact on my life, where I said, I want to go to Temple because Mr. Lesser went to Temple. It was that simple. And back then, you know, there really weren't many options. It was either if you're an instrumentalist, you know, you're going to school, you pursue the classical world, or you're going into jazz. That was kind of the only option, and that's what informed the jazz performance path for me. But little did I know, man, that I feel like the universe just has kind of guided my life, man, in a way that it might look cool on a resume, but in reality, man, it was just things that worked out in a way. When I look back, it was just like I owe a lot to those around me that, you know, helped create those opportunities for me, man. Because when I got into Temple University, that's when I was exposed to an amazing professor in Terrell Stafford, Ben Schachter, and a number of other guys that, you know, they really were heavy into you really respecting the music and the art. And if you're going to learn this music, you better take it seriously. But never did I have to deal with what a lot of musicians are hearing from even some of the living greats now about what good music is and isn't. They respect it at the same time while I'm in college doing those Music Soul Child and Floratry albums and touring with Jill Scott and all that. They never said, hey, don't do this, you know, and because of that, that made me respect that art form even more. And because of that, that actually influenced my decision to leave those tours and actually go and finish college. It was because of that respect they actually showed, man. And again, I think Temple was a big, big motivator in kind of the direction of me pursuing jazz even after college, man.
So what year was that? What year were you finished academically studying?
2001.
So 2001, we're going back almost 20 years now.
Yeah, 2001, yep.
So you graduate. Is there a handful of leads of what's going to happen next? Do you sort of walk out with a certificate and go look in the mirror and go, okay, how are we going to do this? What was your first big break?
Absolutely not, man, because, you know, at the time when I left Jill Scott to go back and finish college, you know, for a young kid all of a sudden making money and, you know, having fun and all that, it just felt like, oh no, what did I do? But that decision to go back to college for me personally opened up a lot of doors, because that's when I started meeting and really taking the composition side really seriously and studying in and out of school, you know, with some of the arrangers and composers, and just taking it seriously in a different way. And when I got out of school, you know, it was playing around Philly, you know, a lot locally, working with Bootsy Barnes and Terrell Stafford, who was my professor in college, you know, put me on his record and I toured with him. But it wasn't all of a sudden like I left school and just went to just touring right off the bat. It was a season of just a hybrid of a bunch of stuff, Latin bands, hitting the library still, you know, when the calls weren't coming, I just started working on scores myself, transcribing Schindler's List, sending my scores to people to just check out. And I just did that. It was a bunch of just hustle plays, man. And actually word just kind of got out about me, and Mogul Miller came to Philly to check me out. And 2 weeks later, I was playing at the Vanguard with Stanley Clark sitting on the couch.
No pressure.
From me, and Ron Carter is sitting at the bar, you know.
No pressure.
Yeah, yeah. But it's one of those things, man. It's just really, it was just a lot of hustle plays and being hungry, you know. And I think that was kind of the defining thing throughout my life and career, has just been just work hard, try to improve yourself, and make uncomfortable comfortable when people aren't watching, you know. So, yeah.
What do you think was a real big break for you?
It was a hybrid of things. I there was never really any particular thing that was the big break for me. It's kind of been different things in different worlds that kind of all worked together in a way that I couldn't have planned for, you know, myself. Like working with Mogul Miller and a friend of mine that's from the greater Philadelphia area as well, Rodney Green, he put in my name to Terrence Blanchard while I was touring with Mulgrew, and I got that call to start filling in for Terrence, and then that opened up a door, and just an immense door, with not just as a musician, but as a writer and a composer. You know, that was, meeting Terrence was monumental in that way. But in terms of, you know, doors that opened up in the actual, you know, industry, that happened to also happen at the same time where I'm writing and touring and recording and producing with artists like Common and Beyond. And so I kind of just use opportunities from each to, you know, test that out. In other words, while I'm working on the composition side, let me start working on orchestrations with Common. And that ended up being documented on records. And it's one of those things, just trying it all and not seeing it as different avenues, but all just one big playground. Trying it all out is what kind of made different doors open up in unique ways. But there was no specific aha moment, man. It was just things kind of happened.
Not one, but two Grammys, which is super impressive. And I think for any musician, that's sort of the one you want on the fireplace mantle if you can get it. What were your thoughts around things like Grammys, awards? Do you think about that now that you have a couple? Do you think, I wonder how one gets more of those? Is it something that's in your brain?
Oh man, I really actually don't, man. I've been told to consider thinking about that more, but in reality, I really don't, because really, man, and those Grammys kind of speak to that, man, because that Grammy was a result. I remember that was Black Radio, the Robert Glasper Experiment. That was the first Grammy, and that kind of speaks to, hey, it's cool when things happen when you're just being honest and being yourselves, because Black Radio happened. They were all first takes, and we were all just sitting around studio and just would record and had that entire album done before you knew it, you know, and that was just us being unapologetically ourselves, you know, and I think that's what made that Grammy so special and the love received from that, because it wasn't like any type of campaign that led to that. We were just being ourselves. And for something that was that culturally relevant to be rewarded, that's special, man. But the motivation behind that actually was not that. It was just, let's create some honest and involve, you know, other amazing minds and amazing, you know, people. So that's kind of been the fabric of everything that I try to do creatively, man. I don't sit here and look at the Grammys every day. They're even in a place where I don't even see them unless I'm just going to look at them, you know. But in reality, that whole uncomfortable thing and just trusting the moment and getting to something that's just uniquely me, that's been the DNA behind every decision, you know, I've tried to make. So I think that's kind of worked out, man. So I'm gonna just keep being naive in that way, just doing art that I feel speaks to me and to the people, and hopefully, you know, the people go on this journey with me, which is what Color of Noise and its spirit is all about. Not trying to bend to any particular category for praise. It's just documenting what I feel is honest and me and us as a band in the moment.
You mentioned Common, and one of my favorite things with Common is the Tiny Desk concert for NPR, mostly because I love Tiny Desk concerts, but this one was at the White House. It's kind of crazy.
Oh, man, that was, yeah. That was incredible.
So what's that phone call like? And then what's that day like?
Oh, man. I can't even remember now how that all came, but I know that came so quickly. There was no rehearsal. There was no planning for that moment. It was just something that came together at the last minute. And I think I flew in either the night before, got up early that morning, and we did it, talked through the songs, and what people are hearing, that's us really reacting in the moment, man. We just did a quick sound check and then boom, recorded. But I'm so glad that style of that moment was documented, because that speaks more to the honesty of kind of how we all kind of work together. You know, we all kind of gravitate to those moments that aren't overly planned, just catching us in moments where we have no choice but to give you art that is us honestly just speaking in the moment. And so when I hear that, that was my first time playing a couple of those songs, you know, in that moment. So, yeah, man.
Well, you don't just walk up to the gig. I mean, it's the White House. Had you been before? Did you, like, what was that experience like?
Well, that was great, man. Unfortunately, I'd been there a few times as musical director for Maxwell and way back, man, years ago. I performed for, you know, the Obamas, thankful and honored, a couple of times. And even back when George Bush was in office, I performed there as well for a jazz performance. So that was a cool experience. But something like that, where the focus was actually just us in the moment and documenting us in the White House that would go out in the world, that was new. That was so cool, man, because before you know it, it was over.
Crazy. What it's an amazing video to watch. You can everybody can check it out on YouTube. It's incredible. I'm curious now, when you think about where you are in your life, when you think about obviously the fact that songwriting and producing and being an artist is you, when you think about bass, being a bass player, the instrument, how do you see yourself? How do you feel about the instrument?
Bass has always been an instrument that I just enjoy, man. It's something, in reality, I don't know if I have even a favorite instrument, though I enjoy the piano probably just as much, which is why I've been shedding so hard at it, just to improve at it, man. But, you know, the bass is something that oftentimes, man, when it comes to actually thinking and hearing melodies, I just hear them as they are. I don't necessarily hear it through the lens of how I'm going to perform it on the bass, you know? So when people are listening to Color of Noise, that's actually my first time playing those melodies at the bass guitar on the album, you know? It's kind of by design. So oftentimes when I'm documenting, I try to document that process where it's kind of just water and how I'm hearing it in a moment. I try to document it in that way, which is why for albums like the second, I jumped around different instruments and all that, because that's kind of like a reflection of my mind. I know I'm known for the bass, but, you know, I tend to hear music, just generally speaking. So when it's time for my art and my albums, I try to approach it in that way, where I'm always thinking of the overall picture and the impact, and make sure the story I'm telling isn't skewed towards just my instrument, because I really enjoy it all.
So you don't hear the song as the bass line first? That's not how your brain operates?
It's not. Unless I choose to just, you know, write a song specifically for bass. For example, you know, of my first album, if I happen to hear something in that timbre, then, you know, great, beautiful. Like if I hear Message of Hope, you know, I heard that while driving, you know, down the highway in LA, and I heard that specifically for bass, you know. So as soon as I got home, I went and documented that bass and that sound and that tone, and just documented it as I heard it. But then on that same album, Dances with Ancestors, or in a couple of other songs, I'm not hearing it from a let me lead with the bass melody, you know, in a typical bass player record type of way. So instead of forcing it to sound like that, I just allow it to be as it is, where maybe Keanu Harold and Marcus Strickland and Aaron Parks carried a melody instead of me. You know, I try to document how I'm feeling. I try to document that musically, you know.
We're recording this conversation during this crazy COVID-19 pandemic, but this new album, as we talked about, used a live band where you went into a physical studio. There were a handful of musicians, but the instruments were, from what I can make out, outside of yourself. It was keyboards, keys, drums, and turntables. I'm curious about why you went down that path and what you were thinking in terms of what am I going to play versus what do I want to bring in?
You know, I've been playing live. I had really been feeling that, just that bass and drum sound. And I feel I've been doing a lot of shows with just me and Black Dynamite, Mike Mitchell. And aside from that, I'd also been doing some gigs with just me and two drums and two drummers and Mike Alberg on keys. And I always hear that sound of organ in some way for my albums, whether it's on one song or every song, maybe just because of my history and playing in church so much and knowing the power of that sound. So when it came down to actually recording Color of Noise, I decided to trust that sound and that I've been touring with and doing live shows with as of late. And Don was, man, he just said, let's just document that. Let's all get in a room and just document that sound, because he felt like that was beautiful in itself. And that's exactly what I did. And when I said I trusted it, I really trusted it. I didn't even try to overplan for it or overplan for, you know, in terms of the actual music played. You know, I really tried to just be free in every way and trust that sound that I'd just been hearing, and then let it, the guys, and let the sound kind of develop into what it's going to be in a way that I couldn't have planned for, you know, myself. But that makeup and that group, that's really just kind of what I had been playing, that sound of two drummers and piano and organ and keys and guys jumping around instruments and one guy jumping off the organ and getting on keys, one guy getting off keys, getting on piano. That whole thing was kind of what I've been doing over the past couple of years. So I just wanted to document that as is and not overthink it. And that's what happened, man. They embraced it in their own way.
One of the, I don't know if it's a quote, but things I've heard either you say or it's been written about this new album, Color of Noise, is this idea of the fluidity of sound. And I think the sentiments have come out really strong just in terms of this conversation with you. I'm wondering, when you say that, are you talking about improv and the language of working together, or is this a very structured album where people had their parts?
It's an album where I wanted to make sure that message of taking it and making it your own, that I potentially that the listener would hear and take and make their own. I want to make sure that people actually performing it were taking it and making it their own as well. So with that said, I asked myself in every part of the process, how do I get out of my own way and out of their way so that feeling and that emotion can come across through them freely without me trying to force the concept. And I realized that comes with subtraction. So for me as a composer, the easy way to go is to just write everything out, you know, to the detail. You know, in some ways, that's the easy way out. You know, the road travel for this was actually just really letting go and only revealing to them in the inception of each song what I felt needed to be revealed to them so that they could take it and run with it in their own way and even make it mean something in their own way. So I would go to the piano before each song. None of them had heard the song before. None of them had heard each song on the album. They hadn't heard it 30 minutes before. They had not heard it at all. So I would go to the piano and just play it and say, yeah, I was just feeling this or that. And I would say, you know, at certain parts, you know, like this melody I'd like to kind of shine through. I might give that perspective through the bass, or let's just look at each other and see what happens. That was kind of the feeling behind each song. Some things were, you know, a lot more detailed than others, but in reality, there is a feeling of freedom that I hear on every song because I know they weren't just sitting there looking at sheet music the whole way through and playing what they think I want them to play. I feel their voices in it, and that was kind of the concept. Let the process of recording mirror the intent of how I wanted to go out in the world, where every person on this album made it their own. So I just got out the way.
Well, one of the tracks that raised my eyebrow, only because I guess I wasn't expecting it, was the song Fall by Wayne Shorter.
Yeah.
Why that song?
Oh, man, I love Wayne, man. I love Wayne Shorter.
Who doesn't?
quite honestly, I don't even know why that song. I just chose that song. I played that song a couple times live. We as a band had never played that song together, all together collectively. And it was just something I wanted to represent. I just respect Wayne so much, you know. People like Wayne Shorter, Herbie, you know, not only do they represent freedom and just doing their own thing unapologetically, I hear in their music, them embracing the times and embracing, you know, everybody that's on the journey with them. I can hear that in Wayne. And when I hear his interviews, he's so just embracing a forward motion, and just, and Herbie Hancock as well, you know, people like them. So I feel like as an artist, it's kind of our duty in our ways, some ways sometimes, just to kind of show, hey, we're also standing on the shoulders of also other heroes. Let's show them that love. So I chose for this album, I chose to let Fall be that song. And what you're hearing, that we hadn't even rehearsed it. We just went and did it.
Such a great tune.
Thank you.
Great, great tune. Great choice, too. It was such a nice, you know, you sort of listen to albums, which mm-hmm. is a rarity these days, because a lot of times it's either songs or playlists. But
exactly.
But when you get to really go through, and I am from, I think I'm about 10 years older than you. I am from that generation that still very much laments the beginning, middle, and end of an artist's journey. So albums are still a very big, important thing. And I love when, I love covers for sure, but I especially love covers when you sort of go, oh yeah, I really like that song. You know, like that feeling
exactly.
in the flow where you're just like, oh, just such a good little treat to have in the middle of it is great.
Thanks. Yeah. I was trying not to, you know, sometimes go back and just try to memorialize everything. And it was just like, no, let's just play it, do it in our own way, not try to reinvent the wheel, but just show, you know, oh, we're aware, you know, of the history too, and just take a moment to show that kind of love too, you know. And again, that's all a part of Color of Noise. It's the question mark of what is it? Just a moment of that, and then it's moments of, you know, me doing, you know, vocal harmonizations and all that, you know. And then there's another moment where it's just kind of a singer songwriter vibe where I'm playing acoustic guitar, all of that, you know. It's just, you know, being willing to allow it all to be part of the story.
We explored in this conversation songwriting and songs and even composition from education through your new album. Mm-hmm. But the other area of your life that I find so interesting is your work in films. Obviously, quite a bit of work with people like Spike Lee. I was a huge fan of the Jackson Pollock documentary, so it was a real treat because I didn't know that you had done work on that. So it was sort of like, oh, that's really cool.
Oh, thank you, man.
Can you talk a little bit about what that's like in relation to being a touring, writing, album artist? Because I know for a lot of musicians that I speak to who are more in genres, whether it be rock or soul or hip-hop,
uh-huh.
they think a lot about even things like doing video game, so forget movies and film scores, but it seems to be this massive leap. What was it like for you, and how did you get so prolific being able to sort of straddle between both?
You know, it was, I'm glad you actually mentioned the Pollock movies and Spike Lee, because that answer kind of even reflects even some of my influences, man. Like, Pollock wouldn't have happened, you know, if people like the great Terrence Blanchard, you know, didn't help look out and put my name in those rooms and where that opportunity could happen. And I remember when I was working on and assisting, you know, and writing for certain films or doing films of my own, his voice and some of my heroes' voices, even what would resonate in the mind, is just like, just be water, you know, trust the moment. Don't make it all of a sudden because you're scoring for a film that another part of you has to, you know, emerge. Maybe just embracing all those sides of you, let that show up in your film writing. Maybe that's what's going to make your sound unique, and not just trying to all of a sudden, oh, since I'm writing for film, write some type of, you know, Copeland style score or something just because I hear that a lot. No, just trust my influences. And so when it was time to compose, man, the mechanics of, you know, writing for film and, you know, getting the technical side together, you know, in terms of writing in the digital age, that's really what you spend so much, you know, time on, and making sure it sounds great and getting your mixing game together and all that stuff and getting a team that knows how to record great scores with you. But in reality, the process, I think me being an artist that just enjoys music, period, that it made it kind of a match in heaven, man, because I would just look at a score, I would look at film with no music to it, and I wouldn't just go to autopilot and think, okay, let me get some strings or let me do, no, I would see it as, wow, this might be cool on just acoustic guitar, or this might be cool on just solo piano, or this might be cool, you know? So I allowed that freedom of thought as an artist inform my decision-making as a composer, which made writing for film as enjoyable as process as writing and arranging for symphonies and all that stuff. I didn't see that as all of a sudden a different side of myself. And I think that kind of mimic what I tried to be about, man, just make that all a story. It's me as an artist, let it all work. So even when I'm writing for myself on albums or arranging for other albums or writing for film, I don't necessarily turn off sides of myself. I allow that moment of just being water to inform every decision making, every part of my decision making, whether it's a solo, an open bass solo. I approach that as the same way as when there's an open canvas of film I'm looking at and I have to create something to it, not separating it, you know?
So I want to be respectful of your time, of course, but I would be remiss if we didn't have a minor conversation before cutting out about the state of music. I mean, we're recording this during this pandemic where we're still, I guess, in certain parts of the world in lockdown. I'm in lockdown. I think Philly's still in lockdown. Yeah. This is going to have, I mean, it's been completely devastation for touring musicians. I don't know how many of the clubs, in particular the ones that fit for what I'll call the smaller genres, whether it's the soul clubs and jazz clubs and even certain rock clubs, are going to make it and survive. Studios, music stores. I mean, I just did a whole session with independent music merchants. Wasn't the best of stories you're hearing from these people.
Yeah.
How are you dealing with it? How are you thinking about it? What are your friends saying? How do you think we're going to come out of this?
You know, it's an interesting time. You know, it's the reality of it financially for many is tough. And, you know, it's one of those things where the rules are changing, seems like every day, week by week, and the realities that people have to adjust to, you know, it's still changing, you know, and it's just an interesting time, man. But what I have chosen to just look at, man, is just the reality of even right now, you know, with the live venues, you know, not producing anything because there's no one outside, no one doing anything, you know, but if you go through social media, if you go through the everyday experience, it's now more than ever, you see how much art is really helping save the psyche right now of people's minds through this time, whether it's the DJs who are raising people's spirits every day, my brother D Nice and beyond, or whether it's, you know, people going on and just supporting musicians, you know, putting music under their clips of moments that are happening politically or culturally and all that stuff and being shared by people and people leaving thousands of comments about how that helped them get through their day. If anything, it's just been a reflection of the appreciation of how much art is needed and how I think it's going to stand the test of time. Now, how that looks in terms of the performance space, you know, that's still yet to be determined. But I've just been encouraged knowing that, you know, different musicians may be going through and writers right now, but yet they're still producing, still creating to the best of their ability, still using that platform in their own way to create and produce, doing what they can, even with the live tutorials, instructionals, creating their own content. I'm excited, you know, when it's rough like this, something new evolves from it. And that's how I choose to see it. Change is inevitable, you know?
You sure are optimistic and give hope, because I wish I had that high. I'm optimistic, but I don't know if I'm that up. I miss the concerts. I miss standing shoulder to shoulder with people and just feeling an experience. So I'm itching. I can't wait for it to come back. I live in Montreal, so they canceled the Montreal Jazz Festival, and it was just like tore my heart out basically. So I'm hoping that this all comes together.
And, you know, the fact that people are showing that sentiment so much, you know, I've been encouraging different artists and musicians, you know, just look at people's reaction, talking about how much they miss it. Just keep trying to fight through this in our own unique ways. You know, be willing to adapt. Be willing to adapt, you know, and don't see this as if a venue, you know, shuts off right now. Be willing to adapt and, you know, figure out other ways to make it through. But still keep creating, figure out ways. If you still have something to say musically, keep working on it. You know, don't see this as a into a mean, because people are showing every day. I mean, my messages are flooded, you know, every day by somebody saying, this song helped me get through my day. How can we support? Blah, blah, blah. And I'm seeing that as, you know, light at the end of the tunnel.
That's great. Derek, I can't thank you enough for your time. Can you let people know where to best connect to you to find out more about Color of Noise and everything else you got going on in your magical world?
For sure. Mitch, I had a great time talking with you, man. This was fun. But yeah, to the world who just wants to follow this journey, you know, you can always follow me, you know, on my website, DerekHodge.com, on my social media handles, Instagram, DHodgeWorld, Color of Noise itself, just at Color of Noise. You can follow me on Facebook at Official Derek Hodge. Go on that journey with me and just give the music a shot. This is just the beginning, this Color of Noise platform. So much coming, and I've really committed to this and just putting more content and art out in the world to just hopefully help lift spirits. Go on this journey with me.
Thank you so much for your time, Derek.
Yes, sir.